welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, broadcasting live from the future on Rush 89 FM in Hamilton. And now, if I remember correctly, iFinity FM in Invercargill has also picked up the show. And greetings also, welcome to the second hour for all our listeners on the online live streams at American Freedom Radio as well. We have a very special guest for you, ladies and gentlemen. His name is Phil Saxby from Normal New Zealand, and he's got quite the amount of experience when it comes to politicking and all that kind of jazz, and I'd like to welcome him to the show. Phil, welcome.
Thank you, well, and I'm pleased to be here.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, well, I'd love it. We've just got a short segment here. If you could just sort of lay out just sort of who you are, Phil, and how you got involved with Normal, because your political experience does not define specifically just to cannabis law reform, does it?
No, that's right. I started out sort of doing political things back in the 1970s with the Vietnam War protests in New Zealand, and then moved on to the anti-apartheid protests, which we ran in New Zealand very successfully, very big movement here in New Zealand against apartheid in South Africa. And then I went on to look at electoral reform, which I'd always been interested in. So we got proportional representation in New Zealand with an organisation called the Electoral Reform Coalition, and I was the secretary of that. And all that time I was in the Labour Party, and then I moved over to the Legalised Cannabis Party and helped. I was sort of asked to help start it up, so I was the secretary of the first secretary of the Legalised Cannabis Party in New Zealand.
Well, the Legalised Cannabis Party in New Zealand, I remember talking with Paul McMillan, I believe he's number seven on the list of the party down in Dunedin, and he said that before the Green Party was set up, the Legalised Cannabis Party was getting a close to 4% of the vote, you know, just 1% below the threshold to get parliamentary representation. And then when the Green Party came in, took all the votes away.
I think that's there's some truth in that, although the
not
actual
sure the
number
figures,
of votes that the Legalised Cannabis Party got when I was the secretary, the party votes was 1 2/3%. So we were 1/3 of the way to the 5% target. There were some seats, and Maori seats in particular, where we were getting around the 4% mark.
Well, and seeing as it's difficult to get political traction on an issue like cannabis law reform, because people see it as an isolated issue, and they want a party to represent a whole broad spectrum of things, not realizing, of course, because like most voters, they never do any analysis or even look at any policies that any party does before casting their vote, other than watching the television for a couple of hours at best. Well, basically, they don't realise that the cannabis law reform movement does tie into virtually every sector of government workings.
Well, the law reform movement certainly has campaigned in the past for, in the health area, medicinal cannabis. It's campaigned for hemp, and we have won that one. That was under the previous government. We now have legal hemp trials, and hemp is grown in New Zealand. So we've made some progress there, and the main one is human rights, and that's where I come in. Just going back to your point about the Greens, so I didn't answer your question fully there.
We can get back to that just after the break here. Ladies and gentlemen, our very special guest is Phil Saxby from Normal New Zealand, who's helped to set up the party there. And we're also going to be talking about electoral reform in New Zealand, because the MMP system is coming under the spotlight of recent times. And of course, the cannabis issue as well. This is the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Back in a moment.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise.
Welcome. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Phil, broadcasting live worldwide from the future, from the sunny slave capital in Auckland, New Zealand, the fabulous fluoride head paradise we have here in our parliamentary dictatorship of the Union. Our very special guest joining us live from the capital, Wellington, is Phil Saxby, the former head of Normal New Zealand, or in fact, he might even be the current head. Phil, welcome back.
Hello. And I am, in fact, the vice president, not the president now.
Aha! I knew I was wrong, which makes me right. Now,
you're right.
We wanted to go in. There was one topic that you and I were discussing last night, mate, is the incidence of drug law reform in Portugal. Now, I'm not 100% sure what's going on there, but apparently, and this has been in the news a little bit, they have relaxed their leanings towards current drug laws set by the UN, US, and various other tyrannical police state-type institutions, and they've been being quite successful at it. Could you please divulge a little bit more?
Yes, certainly. There's information on the web about Portugal, but I hadn't realised at all until that the law changed in Portugal 10 years ago, in 2000, in response to what the Portuguese thought was a problem of drug problems getting out of control, and rather than just deal with one drug, cannabis, they decided that it was actually a wider issue. It was a big issue, and they decided that what they should do is treat all drug use as a health issue and not as a crime. So they moved all of that enforcement out of the police and into either a health-related matters, health treatment sort of issues, or what they call commission of dissuasion. And that means that it's not a court. It's quite deliberately not a court. If you get referred, police, the only thing the police can do basically for possession is of any drug is of small amounts. Possession of any drug is they refer you to one of these commissions of dissuasion, and these are non-judicial authorities. They have a health person on them, a legal person, but like a lawyer, it doesn't have to be a judge or anything, and there's no court process as such.
Well, I mean, think about that versus the system that we currently have where, you're sick, therefore we're going to throw you in jail to protect you.
Exactly. Yes, no, it's a far more sensible thing approach. Obviously, if somebody doesn't have a health problem, then they don't need any treatment. But if they do have an addiction or a health problem, then it may be that the Commission of Dissuasion will be able to direct them in the right direction and not just throw them in jail, as you say. Now, there is still some potential for imprisonment, selling to underage people, there are penalties that are not incarceration penalties. If you're a professional and you are a drug user, you could be restricted or limited in your the practice of your profession. So there are. It's not just, we're all happy, it's all relaxed now. There are certainly rules there, but it's managing those rules and taking a non-judicial approach, taking an approach that, okay, if someone's got a problem, we'll try and fix that and we'll help them if we can. But imprisonment or any sort of fines are the last resort. In fact, it says in the Act, I think, that finding someone is considered to be the last resort. And what they've done as a result is they have dramatically reduce the number of deaths from drug-related deaths. From the pre-decriminalisation year of 1999, the number of drug deaths in Portugal was about 400. 6 years later, it was down to 290.
That's quite a remarkable drop.
You would think that every other country would be beating a pass to their door to say, how do you do it? You would think so.
Well, what I would think is it's very rare for a government to pass a law that actually solves a problem and reduces death.
Well, actually, New Zealand's really good at this. We've reduced road deaths, and I think the law has had something to do with that, and I believe that regulating rather than just outright prohibition is the way to go, and I think regulation works. And it's, you know, we do actually do this in New Zealand. We we've reduced our road deaths down hugely from the 1970s down to what they are now. And a part of that is spending money on roads and
airbags. Due to the cars and the technology.
But it is actually regulation. What I'm saying is regulation actually does work, guys. Get the message. We do it everywhere else. Why don't we do it with drugs? It works.
Well, I suppose that regulation itself means that somebody has to take responsibility for the problem. And at the moment, we have a wonderful system where there's virtually no responsibility whatsoever, either on the part of the public or the police or the criminal gangs or whatever contingents who are trying to make money off of illegal substances, whose prices are nice and high and very profitable because they're illegal.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's a margin for illegal. If you have to make something illegally, then you have to the people who buy it have to take pay for the risk that's of the producer and the seller and so on are taking to get it to you. So obviously there is a margin there. And prices have dropped in Holland. The price of cannabis is lower in Holland, I'm told, than in neighbouring countries, because it is actually a regulated system, and so the price is a little bit lower. But that doesn't mean to say that Holland's got a huge cannabis problem. In fact, it's quite interesting. It has the lowest, one of the lowest teenage rates, use rates around, and we have one of the highest. We have, you know, along with Australia, we have the highest teenage use. The Dutch have one of the lowest rates. You can buy it as an adult legally in Holland, and of course, the tiny houses don't ask for ID, do they?
Well, yeah, and that's the difficulty with an unregulated market, isn't it, is that you
Absolutely.
Cannot control any description of consumption whatsoever. You cannot enforce, you can't license, you can't do anything, really.
You can't do anything.
All you can do is unlawfully search people based upon suspicion alone, and then pray to our God on high, Barack H. O'Barry, that they're carrying something on them.
Well, I think that the police find it quite convenient in some ways to have powers to search, because they can use them and find other things that they might have been looking for. But what it does amount to is that, you know, really the law is a bit of a sham. There's about 1 or 2% of people getting arrested every year, which is, and even that is the highest rate in the world. New Zealand has one of the highest, I saw recently it was the highest rate. It's hard to believe, but I thought the USA would definitely be higher, but apparently I saw a figure that said that we have the highest arrest rate in the world, so we're certainly not the police are not slacking off on this. They are arresting people, but it still only amounts to about 2%, and you can guess who the 2% are. It's people who sort of look wrong, people with the wrong skin colour perhaps, you know, people who's, you know, got a car with a damaged light or something. They would just have a little nosy around, weren't they?
It's the tactic of a bully to basically try and pick on the people who can't actually defend themselves, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, they know that if they search cars, you know, that look that way, then they'll probably, you know, strike it lucky sooner or later, and they'll be able to do it legally, of course, just by you know, using the drug enforcement stuff. Now, you know, that's basically harassment, and that's why we're arguing that the current law is racist and discriminatory, because the effect of it is simply to mean that people who look as though they might be up to no good, you know, the police can just use powers that they wouldn't use against anyone else. They just wouldn't use those powers against somebody driving a Porsche, unless somebody was, you know, blue smoke in their face.
That's why I would argue against regulation in favour of saying if we had no drug regulation, you know, there wouldn't be this problem in the first place. You wouldn't make drug use desirable. You wouldn't make it criminal. You wouldn't make it underground, and you wouldn't have any reason to police such people.
Yeah, there'd be an argument for a libertarian argument, obviously, for free, total, you know, free use, no regulation at all. I think that we are, you know, in some ways closer to the alcohol campaigners then maybe sometimes appear. What we're saying is that there's a extreme at one end of free open market, you know, total commercial, no regulation, just, you know, free market commercial stuff, you know, whatever goes, whatever you can sell goes, let the buyer beware. And at the other end you've got prohibition. Those are the two extremes. And what the alcohol people are saying is we've got to come back into the middle, somewhere in the middle, towards a better regulation system. It's too commercialised at the moment, too much advertising, too free, if you like, too free market. And what we're saying is that the drugs are at the other end, they're at the prohibition end, and they've got to come back into the middle. They've got to come back to a system of regulation, which, of course, is what we used to have. You know, people could buy cannabis as a medicine from the drugstore, from the pharmacy. We had that before prohibition, and that's what we should go back to.
I don't know why people liken free market to total corporate takeover, though, because in a true free market, it's in the buyer's court. You know, so people vote with their wallets, and if someone doesn't like, probably doesn't like the look of a corporation or their practices, then they'll be selected against by way of expenditure. You know what I mean?
Well, that's assuming that you have an informed public, though.
We have an informed public, and we don't have an informed public because we have regulation where the government works in with corporations and they come to cozy little deals and decide not to inform the public on, say, the dangers of smoking for decades, or the dangers of lead added in fuel for decades.
The lack of danger posed by cannabis use for decades.
Yeah, I would say a lot of problems can come about via regulation, because say we don't have a free market economy as such, but we still have a huge amount of corporate influence on government process at agricultural level, pharmaceutical level, banking level, and that is with a huge amount of regulation also.
Well, you've got regulation, in countries like Egypt where. The regulations are just used as a way for people, people with some authority to get bribes, and it's basically a corrupt system from top to bottom in Tunisia and Egypt before this revolution. And that's what that revolution's about, is actually stopping the authorities using regulation to simply enrich the police or whoever gets, the people who take them the bribes. But that's not the way it works in New Zealand. You know, we don't have police taking bribes. We do. Well, put it this way. I'm not saying there's no corruption at all. I'm just saying is that the corruption in the New Zealand system is internationally recognised as at the lowest, right at the low end. We're in the top sort of three uncorrupt societies.
On the perception index.
But there's no reality index. I'm not saying it's not corrupt. I'm just saying, we have a very, compared to Egypt, we have a very, very uncorrupt system. We have a very good public service. I mean, I used to be in the public service. I'm not going to defend everything they do, but, people have got to realise that there's only one thing, only one power that's strong enough to stand against the corporates, and that's government. There's no other power that can stand against the corporate. So if you don't use the government in the public interest, that's what the whole point is. That's why we elect governments to act in the public interest.
But our government works for corporates, do they not?
No, well, they regulate the corporates.
How does our government get its money supply to issue to the New Zealand public?
It taxes people and corporates. But mostly people. Mostly people. The corporates try and escape tax.
How does it actually get the money supply to issue out into liquidity for the whole market, for this whole New Zealand economy to operate?
Well, every country in the world, the governments, collect money from tax and from, GST,
So money comes
from GST
tax.
And personal tax and other taxes, smaller taxes.
Well,
what Will's getting at here is that the power of the issuance of currency is almost as powerful as just being able to wield government taxes and all of that kind of stuff. And the institutions that currently deal out currency, things like the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, which basically the New Zealand Parliament, more or less, doesn't have too much sway over. They're treated as this sort of independent sort of authority, and they basically write their own rule book.
You're not spending real money if you just print it. If you're just saying, the Reserve Bank can print money or something like that, that's not real money. That's just inflation. That's just stealing money from using inflation to steal money from other people.
We have real money now. You're saying we have a backed currency? You're saying we have something.
Yeah, look, we're here to talk about. I mean, I can talk about currency reform another time. But I'm certainly not to come along here to talk about currency reform.
I'm just interested because you said government is our last wall against the corporations. Government is
everything.
We have to defend us from corporations. I say
Absolutely.
That government in this country, since at least the days of Kirk, has worked for corporations. And I base that premise in saying that our money supply does not come from taxation.
Okay, well, you know, people like Winston Peters, people like Winston Peters are pointing out that the government is in the pocket of the corporations, right? Now, that's the problem. So what you've identified is the problem is that the government is too much in the pocket of people, and we've got to take back control of the government, you know, and that's the only way we're going to ever, you know, have any power against the corporations. Have you got any other ideas?
Yeah, I agree with you, Phil.
I've got an answer for taking back power from the corporations.
Yeah, good.
You have a free market. Yeah, it doesn't need. We don't need government to do our work for us.
Okay, that means the corporations control everything. Select. If it's a free market,
people select against the corporations.
You say that's an interesting idea.
Government. People can disempower government. People can disempower corporations too.
Hey, hang on. I have two big supermarkets in Johnsonville. If I select against one, I'm selecting the other, and they're both owned by the same company.
Yeah, and they both sell all the same.
I can't select against them.
if
they're not regulated, I haven't got any select power at all.
This is a great point you just brought up. Let me just speak a minute. This is a great point you brought up. You said you've got two supermarkets in Johnsonville. If you select against one, you're selecting for the other. Who said the paradigm is two-party? Who said that's your only two options? What makes you think that in the whole freedom, the scope of human interaction on this planet, that you have two options for a source of food? What sort of narrowed perspective is that? And that is the problem with the system we have, and there's two parties.
Yeah, well, I'm growing my own, of course, but as you would expect me to do.
We can't do that. We couldn't do that. People have only done it for thousands of years.
Yeah, and what's interesting, Phil, is that the U.S. government in particular is now cracking down on people being able to supply their own food. There's an article from Natural News not too long ago where a man was charged $5,000 for growing a organic garden in his backyard.
Really?
Yeah, man. So it's really freaky right now. And Will's right to a certain extent, because the government and corporations have started to come together and say Monsanto, for example, one of the largest agricultural corporations in the world, is now lobbying government to such an extent that they're basically able to make government, well, not make, but, you know, more or less, they're able to get them to pass legislation which is in their best corporate interest. Now, this is what lobbying is all about, right? And I think that there should be a certain extent of lobbying with government, because obviously people need to have a say in some description of the word. But when it becomes disproportionate, when the voice of the people gets drowned out by the voice of the corporations, that's when we've got corporatism. And as Mussolini said, corporatism should be more correctly termed fascism, because it's when the interests of the corporation take over that of the state. That's fascism.
Oh, yeah. You've been reading John Rawls's Saul, have you?
No, I don't read.
Yeah, no, that's good. No, I'm right on with you there. Yes, the corporate, the people have to understand. Yeah, the corporate sector is the all powerful thing in a modern society. Yep.
Yeah. Well, moving on, back to the MMP debate here, because we're coming up to a referendum here, Phil, and my considered opinion is that the government, particularly the National Party and Labour parties, are pushing so that the... we'll go to break.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road. When along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. On American Freedom Radio, and incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, broadcasting live from the future. Our very special guest joining us live from Johnsonville in Wellington is Phil Saxby from normal.org.nz. Phil, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, and just before we got cut off on the break, before we wanted to go into MMP, and I'd love it if you could actually break this down for me, because one thing that we didn't get to address earlier on was how the Greens kind of came in under MMP, and considering we've got an international audience, could you define what it actually is?
Oh, sure. MMP can be defined in one fairly long sentence, but I'll do it in several sentences to make it a bit easier. Basically, it's a proportional system where people get two votes. If you vote, you get one vote for a party, so that's the proportional part. Every party gets representation in proportion, so that if a party gets 5% of the vote, they get 5% of the seats. And the second vote is a vote in a, for a person in your own local area. So it's a geographical electorate like you have in the United States and in many countries with just one member in that electorate, in that seat, as we call it. And so at the end of the day, there will be 60 or so members elected from the electorates, and every party will get extra members, members of parliament, to top it up to its share, fair share. That's how it works. Okay. The only little extra wrinkle is that you do need to have a 5%. You have to get 5% of the party vote to get any extra seats from this topping up process. Or you have to win one of the electorate seats, okay? And there are, as well as the 60 or so general seats covering the whole of New Zealand, there is 7 Maori seats open to people who are of Maori descent, and they also cover the whole of New Zealand. The New Zealand is divided up into two lots of electorates, Maori electorates and general electorates.
Okay, okay. Now, in terms of the Green Party, when they first came in, it's just like these parties, and this is the cool thing about New Zealand, I find, is that parties that are very, very, very small, like the Greens, actually have a shot at getting in. Now, transitioning from that, of course, what happened to the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party once the Greens got in? Because they also campaigned on a harm minimisation platform and kind of trumped the vote to a certain extent, in my opinion.
Well, the Legalised Cannabis Party did get, as I say, 1/3 of the way to the target of 5% at its first shot. And then on the second time round, it actually dropped back. And one of the reasons for that was that the Greens recruited one of our leading candidates, one of the party's leading candidates, a Legalised Cannabis Party candidate. He was on the Legalised Party Cannabis Party list, and he then joined the Greens and was elected in a Member of Parliament for the Greens. So it was really one election when there was no competition, and the Legalised Cannabis Party got about 1.66%. The following election, they got 1.4%, and the Greens got over the 5% threshold and brought Nandor Tanchos into Parliament.
Mm-hmm. And many current Green MPs and former Green MPs have actually had their teeth cut in the political spectrum with the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party, like, for example, Matiria Ture, yes?
Yes, Matiria is another success story, if you like, for Normal, because she was Secretary of Normal and also a candidate on the Legalised Cannabis Party list. And she followed Nandor into Parliament and is now the co-leader of the Greens Party.
And we've interviewed her before on the show. She's a very, very lovely woman. And I would think that, well, any kind of political diversity needs to really, really be emphasised, I think. And this is something that really ticked me off about the Botany by-election conference that happened last night, is that there were 10 candidates for the by-election and they only allowed 5 of them. Not including the Legalised Cannabis Party people, because, oh, well, it'd be too difficult to organise. Well, if democracy is too difficult to organise for you, and let's just say I'm not devoting democracy because it simply doesn't work with an uninformed, uneducated, brainwashed public, operatively, the consequences of not allowing some voices to be heard and only allowing others are absolutely dire, in my opinion. And this is why this is one reason why I like MMP, but also, on the other hand, a lot of people have different opinions about it. It's not like first past the post would be any better, but I don't fully understand the system, and maybe that's a good thing.
Well, it's probably just as well that some people don't really understand the system, but in general, you can't really go wrong. If you choose the person that you want to represent you in your local area as the best person, you know, the best the person that you think is the best qualified to do that job. And that might be a different from a different party from your normal, the one you normally support. But if you choose that best person, you can't really go wrong. You know, you might not win, but you've made your honest choice. And if you choose the party that you would like to be in the government or running the government, better still even, and you just vote for that party, you can't go wrong. Doesn't matter what other considerations happen about, you know, what parties that qualify based on the sort of MPs that get in from the party list and not from the electorate and all that sort of thing. Really, you can't do any better than simply make the most honest choice you can of your best candidate and your best, you know, party, best person for the candidate for the electorate, and your first choice of party. Don't do anything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've participated in a number of elections, and the very first election when I knew nothing, I voted for the Greens. The second election when I knew a little a fair amount, really, I mean, I voted for the Legalised Cannabis Party. And in this next election, I know a little bit more than that, so I'm voting no confidence because I literally have no confidence in the system. It seems like the progression of economics, the progression of political debate seems to be going in one direction, taking away people's civil liberties, selling out the country to offshore interests, and basically subverting any type of political or judicial process to a dog and pony show. You know, no real change ever seems to come out from the voting process. It's why I get involved in politics day in and day out, because you have to tell your governments on a daily basis what they do. People out there who think that they can change policy or even really have a terribly large amount of sway or influence in the country by ticking a box on a piece of paper once every 3 years, you've got to be out of your mind, in my opinion.
Well, obviously, I mean, it's just a mathematical fact that, you know, if you cast one vote out of 2 million, your 1/2 millionth of a share in the actual election is going to be pretty small. And if you don't want to vote, then don't vote. But what you're doing, what you are doing during the year is obviously the important thing. And if you're doing what you are obviously doing, then, you know, you're actually helping people to be part of a democracy because you're helping them to be informed. So I think, you know, you're certainly taking part in in our New Zealand democracy if you're doing that, and you don't have to vote. That's the least of your, the lowest level, if you like, and you don't have to do that. It's not, as you say, it's 1/2 millionth or something.
It's just our candidates that worry me the most. I mean, even if we, you know, whether we decide to vote or not, I mean, what philosophical grounds are they running upon concerns me. And, you know, just going back to our corporation-government debate, I mean, what makes people feel that government or corporations have any different intention?
Well, we can see the results in what they do. We can see when we have corporations in charge of things, they may well try and cut corners if they're allowed to. Who knows? The Pike River disaster could have been caused by corner cutting. I've heard some rumours of that kind. I don't know if you have. So corporations will do, if they are not regulated, they will basically do whatever they can to just achieve their purpose, which is to make money. And everyone knows that, so that's all quite straightforward, and everyone's very honest and everything like that. Some people have to close their eyes to it a little bit, but they do know that that's the purpose of the corporation. The purpose of government is to act in the public interest. Now, if you think the National Party represents the public interest better than every other party, then you obviously should be, you know, either voting for it or have some reason in your own head as to why you don't believe in the public interest, why you think the public interest is against your own private interest.
Essentially, though, a corporation, if a corporation wants to make the most money, then they should serve the public interest also.
No.
See, but they don't.
Why
when
they?
Governments...
They, no one ever asked them to do that.
Well, they have to, because if you want to sell lemon-flavoured chilli on dog shit, sorry, excuse my French,
you can't say that stuff on the FCC regulations.
Oh, sorry, yeah. But what I'm saying is that in China they sold poisoned milk because it was cheaper.
If you
and then it got found out.
How much are you going to sell? How much are you going to make? How much money are you going to make? So corporations serve public interest the same way government does.
No, it's completely false. That's completely false and a complete misunderstanding. The corporation has no obligation to the public whatsoever unless
like
the public
does.
You've bought into this whole bloody right-wing crap that I'm fight all every day of my life. What are you going on about? You can't possibly believe that corporations are acting in the public interest.
No,
they
I
only
didn't
act
say
in the public interest by accident.
No,
only by accident.
Let me talk for a minute here.
Yeah, sure.
We have
so you think the market works?
Where we have governments working in with corporations. You feel they're different people. If you break it down, a government is comprised of individuals who have certain belief structures. A corporation is comprised of individuals who have certain belief structures. Taking apart your preconceived notion that one just wants to make money and the other one wants to serve the public, if you understand the individuals behind them, you'll see they're interchangeable. Hence why...
That's the revolving door, isn't it?
Hang on. The people that are in the public...
Let me carry this on.
Yeah, go on.
Hence why many corporates find themselves in government jobs and vice versa. They have similar ideologies. If you look a bit closer, you'll find they're in similar groups, similar organisations, similar schools, similar cliques. You'll find that they have similar intentions for society. That's why they work so well together. If you reduce the size of government... You give corporations a smaller tool to bash people's brains out with daily.
No, you give the corporations more freedom to do their own bashing.
No. You give them more freedom.
You're just going to create poisoned milk in New Zealand like they have in China.
No, sorry.
If you're going to reduce the role of government.
You give them more freedom, but freedom without protection, if they're not in cahoots with the government, if they're not receiving money from them, freedom without protection is dangerous to a corporation. Understand that. Freedom is dangerous. Freedom is living by a knife edge. If you then have this insulating level or layer of government, they can do what they want. The government will cover up for them. They'll get immunity via regulation and legislation and so on. You see what I mean there? And then, okay, take away the corporates and we just have this nice, loving government running things. Where's the oversight? We can't even get oversight into who New Zealand owes its foreign debt to, and that's expanding at a rate of over $300 million a week. And so where's this great government you speak of that serves the public
it's
interest?
It's $450 million a week now, according to the BNZ analyst.
Just giving them the benefit of the doubt. Where is this public interest that's being fulfilled?
So you're saying that it's better to have no government, even if it's only partly committed to public interest.
Don't say what I'm saying. Tell me why it's better to have a government that keeps its debt completely secret from New Zealand public as it expands, millions of dollars on each person's head every week.
Look, it's about whether you think the market whether corporations want the market to basically be the only arbiter of everything, and you're basically saying the market is going to work, and that's what the corporations say. What I'm saying is the market is a way for the corporate. If you just leave everything to the market, you'll just simply leave it to for the corporations to do anything they want. Now, what I'm saying is the only power that can possibly stop that, the only power that can limit that, is government.
Hold on. Will, can you just let Phil speak, please?
The only power that can actually control corporations simply using market forces to do whatever they like is government. And that's what we've been doing, before democracies. This happened, governments felt some need to try and control market behaviour before democracy came along. But the difference with democracy is that we actually choose the people that are going to have this role. And although we might make bad choices, because the corporates might well try and influence bad choices. Am I talking or am I not? Am I going to hang up on you or not?
That's your choice, free market.
Yeah, fine. What I'm saying is, I'm actually explaining to you that we choose the government, right? The corporates may influence our choices and may, as you say, brainwash us or try and make us choose the government that's friendly to them. Obviously, why wouldn't they? They've got the money to spend, so they will naturally try and make people choose the government that's friendly to them. But everybody knows that the purpose of the government is to act in the public good. Even people who are absolutely adamant that, they hate politicians will tell you that they believe the purpose of politicians should be to act in the public good.
That's right. I completely agree there, Phil.
I agree too.
That's the belief, but the reality is sometimes a little bit skewed. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Our very special guest is Phil Saxby, coming to us live from Wellington. Final segment after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, the show that's all about business time. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Our very special guest joining us for the final segment today is Phil Saxby, coming at us live from Johnsonville in Wellington, I believe. Phil, welcome back.
Yeah, and it's a very, very sunny day here in Wellington, a magnificent February in New Zealand. Come and join us.
Yeah, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, in the Gulf of Oil, Kano, pack up, come to New Zealand for a nice summer holiday.
So, Phil, I think we're misunderstanding each other a bit here. I mean, I'm not a right-wing conservative in the sense that John Key supposedly is, or the National Party, or any of those shills. I'm someone who believes in freedom. And I see government as a big middleman. And if you try and sanitize reality, if you try and sanitize the world we live in at all and make it more safe and friendly and more cozy for everyone and put cotton wool in every corner, you'll only ever make it more dangerous. You'll only ever make it more dangerous. You'll only ever cost people lives. You'll only ever cost people freedoms. I'm against the Patriot Act because I don't believe that sacrificing certain liberties gives me more freedom. In the same way, I'm against growing government to protect me from people I can protect myself from. See? Because Nikki Kaye down the road is no more capable than me. In fact, the little turd is far less capable. And so I don't need... What we need is a code where government can't trample over people and corporations can't trample over people. But then other than that, we don't need too much.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, Phil, is have you heard about the constitutional jury standpoint where if a politician refuses to answer a question or doesn't answer it to any great effect, you can then go to a jury of your peers and say, look, I need these questions answered. Here's why. It's important to the country. And if the jury agrees with your case, okay, great. That politician's not doing their job. They're in a fiduciary position of responsibility and they're not performing their duties. Okay, we suspend them until they do.
Well, all I can say is that only in America would people dream of trying to use the law to make politics work. I can't believe that I'm hearing this. This is just weird to me. You know, you go and find out from the politicians what the story is. You get your journalists, you drum up stuff. You know, you actually take part in politics. That's how you get your solve political problems. You don't go to the law courts and try and do it. That's the most expensive way of trying to solve anything. We only use it for the most rare decisions of, you know, incarceration and stuff like that.
Oh, no. What we're talking about here is a completely different thing. The constitutional jury system has never existed anywhere ever before because the Crown and the judiciary have what's known as sovereign immunity so that they can't be second-guessed and they are more or less above reproach.
Yeah, we know and, this is still just the
American legalistic sort of approach to solving a problem, though, taking it to court, making lawyers rich. I don't believe in that one. Sorry.
Vinny, cutting out the lawyers as well. It's citizens explaining to another group of citizens what's happening, and then the citizens make the decision. There's no lawyers or judges involved here.
I'd love to see a model for this. I've never heard of it before.
Anyway, Vinny, we're arguing details. I want to know just on a general principle basis here, Phil. Do you believe that by growing the size of government, we can empower people?
Even the framing of that question is just absolutely appalling.
Why? It's a simple question.
We can reduce the size of government and increase the power.
Government itself has no power, right?
And we so can the reduce the size of government and increase its power easily.
Pardon, sorry, can you repeat that, Phil?
We can reduce the size of government and increase its power easily.
Yeah. Well, I would say that public participation in politics, I think, is kind of like at an all-time low. Wouldn't you agree, Phil? And this kind of leads to an awful lot of political apathy. I mean, I'm sure in your experience, going out and trying to inform the public of things that aren't totally mainstream, like, for example, cannabis is not dangerous and that sort of thing, you encounter a lot of apathy within the general populace. And my explanation for this is that because people are not intricately involved in the political process on a daily basis, it really fosters that apathy. And so, therefore, critical analysis of government activity becomes much, much less. And therefore, they can probably get away with a lot, lot more.
Well, it's a big question. I think that it's quite possible for citizens to have a very profound effect on governments, and that applies in New Zealand just as much as it does in Egypt. I'm really surprised that anybody's asking that question today after Egypt and Tunisia, and today Bahrain and Yemen, or tomorrow Bahrain and Yemen. You know, people can do it. You know, it doesn't, it's actually, we've done it before. We got MMP. You know, we got ACC, a world first system. This is government acting in the public interest to do something which is done better in New Zealand than anywhere else in the world.
The public, is fluoride in the public interest? Is aspartame in the public interest?
Accident compensation system, accident ACC, accident compensation.
Is fluoride in the water in the public interest? Is aspartame in our soft drinks in the public interest? Is estrogen mimicking plastics in our foods and water containers, is that in the public interest? Is that government serving the public interest?
Hang on, I haven't heard of half of these things. What are you talking about?
Of course you haven't, because you believe in the system so much. This
no, I don't. I'm just saying, if there's a serious problem,
and half of it and go along with everything.
Yeah, if the problems like DDT and that in the food chain were not recognised, and then people had to protest, and then, you know, we got the DDT
fluoride added to water. Fluoride
you know,
added to the public water supply.
It's politics.
It's politics. Is it? Are they enacting? We can have 90% of Europe against it. It's banned all throughout Europe. The EU's banned it even. And New Zealand, somehow our government is maintaining the public interest by pumping fluoride through our water supplies? Labour, National, regardless, Green Party, you name it?
Yeah, and that's the point we're trying to define.
I mean, no, allow Phil to answer.
Even the nutcases support fluoridation. Half of the nutcases support fluoridation. I'm really surprised that you're opposed.
Mm-hmm. Well,
So you can't.
I'm saying half the nutcases support fluoridation. The other half, obviously, are opposed to it.
It's amazing, Phil. Come on, he's picked up.
I mean, I just talked to a real nutcase, a really bad religious nutter from originally from America, who's now living in Gisborne. God, it was terrible. And of course, you know, he actually admitted that the fluoridation might be the one of those rare cases where government got it right. And I thought, you know, every other thing we believe in, you know, we're just completely opposed.
But you haven't got an opinion on fluoride. You just think it's good because government does it. Interesting.